From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week, Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to National Journal, and Nihal Tusi, foreign affairs correspondent at Politico. Our moderator is columnist for USA Today and West Wing Reports, Paul Brandes.
Hello, thank you for joining us, and here are the issues. World leaders gather in Normandy for the 75th anniversary of D-Day. President Trump threatens Mexico with tariffs. The House of Representatives passes legislation to create a pathway to citizenship for so-called Dreamers. And Sudan cracks down on a democracy movement. Well, let's start with the D-Day. It was 75 years ago that the largest amphibious invasion in history occurred. That's when Allied forces led by the United States crossed the English Channel to land in Normandy. That, of course, was in Nazi-controlled France. It really was one of the titanic battles of World War II, and world leaders gathered there to mark the occasion. Tom, that was a long time ago, and for some listeners, 75 years. Explain the significance of D-Day.
Well, I think if the Allies had not been victorious in Normandy and then later in the rest of France, I think the war would have gone on much longer. It's conceivable that the Allies would have lost. We'll never know. But it was definitely a turning point in World War II. And of course, it will always be the greatest amphibious landing in history, because with satellites now, you'd never be able to pull off this massive influx of ships and men across the English Channel. And so historians, presidents, future presidents, former presidents have all said that the Normandy landings were the pivot point of World War II, and I think that's correct.
Now, Holly, 4 years after the war ended, the U.S. and those European allies formed NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, this military alliance, with the express purpose of maintaining security in Europe, preventing another world war. And that's been quite successful for a very long time now. And yet the alliance itself, after all this time, some are questioning it, including President Trump, who had some stirring things to say at Normandy. But nevertheless, in the past, at least, he has questioned the validity of the alliance going forward.
Well, President Trump's approach to a lot of things, especially on foreign policy, is very transactional. So for him, it's a question of, money and how much the U.S. is giving versus making off of NATO. And so his big concern about NATO has been that other countries are not spending as much on defense as they have pledged to do so to keep up this alliance. And he feels like the U.S. is being ripped off. And, although there has been some progress made on that front, President Trump isn't the first president to even be concerned about that. He, still has this just kind of general wariness about this idea that the U.S. would try to go and fight for some of the smaller countries in this alliance who he feels are not carrying their fair share.
It's been recommended but not required that the countries spend about 2% of their GDP on the military. And to Nahal's point, only a handful of countries are actually doing that. Nevertheless, after the Russian, takeover of Crimea in 2014, you said obviously that other presidents have urged spending to go up. Spending began to rise within NATO overall long before Mr. Trump came to office, but it's still not high enough for him.
No, it's definitely not high enough for him. This is a campaign pledge of his to get NATO to pay what he considers to be a more fair share of alliance expenses. We'll be talking about this long after President Trump is out of office in either 2 years or 6 years. But this is an article of faith with him. He feels like that the United States taxpayer is being forced to pay a disproportionate burden of the common defense. I think the bottom line is President Trump does not like alliances. He doesn't like multilateral solutions to things. He likes bilateral, mano a mano. And I think you saw that somewhat in Normandy, where he prefers a different sort of diplomacy and problem solving, and I would agree that his whole modus operandi is transactional.
But even with his preference for bilateral deals, nevertheless, the case can be made, as we just talked about, 75 years that this collective defense theory has certainly worked out quite well. Not everything has to be a bilateral, does it?
The only time that NATO has ever actually invoked Article 5, which is that collective self-defense mechanism, was after September 11th. And it was NATO allies who came to the U.S. aid after September 11th, and they have fought with us in Afghanistan and other places. And people often bring that up when critiquing President Trump's approach to the alliance. Russia's rise, China, there's all these other threats that are emerging. And there's legitimate questions about whether NATO really is prepared to take on some of these challenges, and whether the funding really is there every time. So, and at the end of the day, the fact that this argument that President Trump has against NATO, that some of the countries aren't carrying their fair share, it does seem to resonate with a lot of people in the United States. And so if you are a supporter of NATO, you probably need to do a better job articulating why this alliance still matters.
And in fact, the weakening of the alliance, or at least the perception that it's weakened, is sort of a music to the ears of Vladimir Putin, of course, the Russian president, who has sort of made clear that sort of the Russian goal to either weaken or divide the alliance. And some people say that sort of what Trump has done has played into the Russians' hands. And yet Trump at the same time has made some good points. Look, you've got to spend more. And he's telling the Germans these energy pipelines with Russia, if you want to bolster your security, you should not be energy dependent upon the Russians. That seems like a fair point.
He's not the first president to make these points. Yeah. And it's important to remember that. He's just been much more blustery and forceful about this. And it's interesting because the NATO Secretary General has been publicly actually giving President Trump credit for an increase in a lot of the NATO members' spending. Now, if you look carefully, you'll see that actually it began before President Trump. But I think what NATO supporters have realized is that if you give the president credit, that might be enough for him.
Well, you know, Tom, President Trump has gotten a lot of criticism in the past for his comments on NATO. We were just talking about that. And yet his remarks in Normandy seem to have been pretty well received, talking about the importance of values that have united the Western alliance for 75 years now, even more important than sort of the backdrop, the personal and the political feuds that a lot of the media talks about. Those words count when you talk about values and alliances and security. You
know, I have a theory, Paul, that if you haven't been to Normandy, if you haven't been to Pointe du Hoc, where the 2nd Ranger Battalion scaled the cliffs on D-Day at Omaha Beach, you can't really understand just what a big deal it was. I mean, the notion that it saved D-Day saved democracy is for real. I've been fortunate enough to be there three times, two with presidents and one with my family. And to stand at Omaha Beach now, and it's such a tranquil place now, it's a miracle that anybody got off that beach alive on D-Day, but they did, and the rest is known to history.
And you know what was interesting, Nahal, is that it wasn't just President Trump who was there, but a lot of leaders of Congress, Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, in fact. But nevertheless, most eyes were on the president and how he behaved. How did he behave?
Overall, he actually behaved pretty well, is the general sense that people are getting. When he was flying to the country, he put out some tweets. But during his time with the Queen, while he was at Normandy, generally speaking, in the public portions of things, people felt like he conducted himself fairly well. They were impressed with his speech. They were impressed generally with his decorum. And he really did seem in awe of some of what he saw at D-Day. Now, this being the 75th anniversary, a lot of congressional leaders were there, and Nancy Pelosi was given the opportunity to make some comments about President Trump. She declined. She said she doesn't do that when she's overseas. She doesn't talk about the president. But the president did do one thing that did get some criticism. He gave an interview to Fox News in the same vicinity of D-Day events, and he criticized Bob Mueller and some other aspects in the U.S. And some folks felt like that was a bit of an odd note, but overall, they felt like he actually handled himself pretty well.
Well, let's move on here and talk about immigration for a second, another big issue for this president, of course. He seemed to catch just about everybody off guard when he said he might impose tariffs on Mexico. Now, why would he do that? The president seems to think that the Mexicans aren't doing enough to stop these undocumented migrants from coming to the United States. Your thoughts on this, Tom?
Well, Paul, I think that's right. The numbers of illegal immigration at the southern border of the U.S. are growing exponentially. Despite the president's intent to stop it, he and his Department of Homeland Security have not been able to stop it. And of course, this president, among many strengths and weaknesses, he is reluctant to absorb responsibility when things don't go wrong. It's somebody else's fault all the time. And in this case, he feels very profoundly that the Mexicans have not been doing enough, that the Mexicans have been playing the United States for suckers. That's the kind of language he has used. And he believes that the Mexicans have to step up and help the U.S. stem this massive wave of illegal immigration. And talks have continued in Washington. The Mexicans have apparently offered to send 6,000 Mexican National Guard troops to its border with Guatemala to make it much more difficult for Guatemalans to get into Mexico and then into the United States. These talks are continuing even as we speak, and we'll have to see how they work out. I guess I'm thinking that this is the president threatening as a negotiating tactic, and will at the end back off. We will see.
It seems to me, and help clear this up, is that the president's policies perhaps seem to be butting heads with each other. And what I mean by that is he just finished this big new trade package, really an overhaul of NAFTA with Canada and Mexico, that forbids the kind of tariffs that he's now threatening to impose on Mexico, and yet here he is threatening to impose them. So how can he have his cake and eat it too on tariffs?
Well, when you look at what President Trump really cares about, the number one thing tends to be his base, right? So a lot of this is about politics. He knows that the immigration issue resonates among his base more than just about any other. And he's willing to use it and take a hardline stance on it, even if it undermines other domestic and foreign policy objectives this president has. So I'll give you another example of where these policies have collided. The travel ban. The president and his people say that they care a lot about the Iranian people. They want the Iranian people to do well, that they don't like the Iranian government, and yet they impose a travel ban that bars Iranians from coming to the United States. So it seems like they don't really care about the Iranian people. So yeah, I mean, this is, the president often takes this approach. Now, on the issue of tariffs on Mexico, a couple of things to remember. First of all, a lot of the people who are coming from Central America through Mexico to the United States are people seeking asylum. They come to the border, they turn themselves in. This is legal. They are not illegal immigrants in a number of cases, or many cases. But that aside, it just raises this question of how often can the United States use the economic tools it has as its advantage to get what it wants on the national security side or immigration or other fronts. And this administration uses these economic tools, including tariffs, including sanctions, to such a great degree that there are fears that other countries are going to make moves to try to lessen their reliance on the U.S. financial system because they don't want to somehow get caught up in this economic warfare that this president is willing to wage.
So in other words, it could sort of boomerang on the United States in some way.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah. Right now, U.S. sanctions, for example, often target other countries because they rely on the U.S. dollar. So if you're another country and you're thinking, you know what, maybe we should switch the main currency we rely on to the Chinese currency or some other currency. It's not very practical at the moment, but it's making people think these thoughts. And in the long run, it could be a major weakening of the U.S.
And you know, Tom, the president has actually encountered a lot of opposition to these proposed Mexican tariffs, U.S. manufacturers, all kinds of companies, and including a lot of members of his own Republican Party. What happens now?
Well, in Europe, the president said Senate Republicans can't possibly try to fight me on these tariffs. It would be very foolish for them to do so. That was his word, foolish. But I think this is an issue that resonates with Republicans because it affects a lot of the base.
Well, let's pause for a short break. More Issues in the News in just a moment.
Issues in the News is coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. Did you know you can download the program? It's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com.
While you're there, go ahead and check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also, visit us on Facebook, then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel. Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to National Journal, and Nihal Tusi, foreign affairs correspondent at Politico. Our moderator is columnist for USA Today and West Wing Reports, Paul Brandis.
Welcome back. You know, before the break, we were talking about D-Day and this gathering of world leaders in Normandy. Of course, it was interesting to see President Trump and Queen Elizabeth. She has now met every president since Harry Truman, and she threw Tom, the president, quite a bash at the Buckingham Palace.
Well, this is only the third president to have gotten a state, an official state dinner from the Queen and the British. And so the president loves the show. He loves pomp. He loves pageantry. He loves all of that. I don't think there was much business, if any, conducted on this trip, but he loved the spectacle of it, and he was in England a year ago, and he didn't feel like he got enough attention. The Queen, I guess, is, and the British government are walking a tightrope. President Trump is very unpopular in England. I mean, on the eve of arriving in London, he reacted to some criticism from the mayor of London by calling him a stone-cold loser, and also some have wondered whether it was wise for him to wade into the succession battle to see who's going to be the next prime minister. He has a favorite or two, but so he's very unpopular. On the other hand, the importance of the Anglo-American relationship cannot be overstated. And so the Queen was trying to thread the needle to give him the kind of love he needs, while also reflecting the realities of the importance of this longstanding relationship.
And it's especially important because of Brexit. The UK is trying to leave the European Union and it needs friends. So it has to show America that it loves America and wants strong bilateral ties.
All right. Well, back in this country, the House of Representatives, that, of course, is the lower chamber of our Congress, passed what's called the American Dream and Promise Act of 2019, which would offer a path to citizenship for, I think, about 2 million undocumented immigrants, including, of course, these so-called Dreamers who were brought to the United States years ago, often as children. It looks, though, Tom, like this bit of legislation is not going to go anywhere in the Senate.
The old phrase "dead on arrival," I think, comes to mind here. The president has a senior domestic advisor named Stephen Miller, who is a very arch conservative guy. Immigration is his issue. He's not only opposed to illegal immigration, as many Americans are, he's opposed to legal immigration. He thinks that shouldn't be happening at all, and he has the president's ear. And I think there is no chance that this bill that was passed in the House will even be brought up in the Senate, which is controlled by Republicans.
You don't know how I think President Trump ended DACA, I think, in 2017. That stands for the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals Program. It's part of his anti-immigration stance that you just mentioned, Tom. But the Supreme Court seems likely to take up DACA in the next couple of months, considering whether to put it on the docket. What do you think is going to happen with that?
It's really tough to tell. I think that with the fact that we have essentially a conservative majority Supreme Court right now, the odds are pretty good that they'll want to weigh in and that they will possibly take the Trump administration's side on this. I think a lot of assumptions about the Supreme Court have been turned upside down in terms of, you know, their willingness to overturn precedents or not when it comes to the conservatives on the court. But, you know, ultimately, I just think this is the type of thing that really is about election politics more than anything. And the House Democrats can now say, hey, look, we voted to help these people and the Republicans didn't. And they can use that as a way to rally their base in 2020.
So as you said before, it's all about his base.
Yeah. There's a song, right? It's all about the base. What was it?
You know, Trump has his own immigration proposal, of course, one that emphasizes job skills over the current emphasis on family ties. We have big labor shortages in the United States, and some people ask, well, what's wrong with emphasizing job skills that we need in this country, Tom?
There's nothing wrong with that, but there are a lot of a lot of jobs that go begging in the United States. I remember George W. Bush, the 43rd president, used to say, there are jobs that need to be filled in this country that Americans simply will not accept. And so we need not illegal labor, but labor from overseas, from people who want to come here to help with those jobs. There's nothing wrong with it, but once again, it's the president appealing to his base, trying to make people believe that there is a horde of people coming across the border, crusades, caravans, and that they are out to destroy America's way of life. And this is an argument that probably doesn't resonate with a lot of people, but it does resonate with the hardest of his hardcore advisors.
Is it at all possible that Trump's immigration plan and what the Democrats have done, is there any way they can bridge their divide and come up with something here? They seem so far apart on the stuff. What is there any way they can kind of bridge their differences?
I think there's really recognition on both sides of the aisle that if you want to solve the illegal immigration problem, what you need to do is fix the legal immigration system. So I actually think that President Trump and others they know that there is common ground. You have Jared Kushner, Trump's son-in-law and advisor, coming up with his own immigration plan. I do think there is possibility that this is something that could ultimately have bipartisan support. But I cannot underestimate the influence of Stephen Miller in all of this. Every single time there has been some measure of hope that both sides would come together and that President Trump seemed to be on board, Miller will weigh in and he will destroy everything. And you cannot underestimate his influence and his ability to convince Trump to back out, even when Republicans and Democrats, for the most part, are on the same side.
Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, who has developed into one of President Trump's most ardent supporters, has said several times there will never be an immigration deal. There's an immigration deal to be had, but it'll never happen as long as Stephen Miller is running immigration policy out of the White House. And that's for a Trump loyalist like Graham, that's saying a lot.
Well, let's go to Africa now. Dozens of people reported dead in Sudan following a violent crackdown on pro-democracy protests. Now, the backstory here is that demonstrators had been occupying the square in front of a military headquarters in Khartoum. That's the capital there. And Nahal, this was just before the president there, Omar al-Bashir, was overthrown after about 30 years in power. Explain to our listeners what's going on in Sudan.
Basically, the president was overthrown, and then you had a military group of military folks essentially try to take control. The civilian protesters who had pushed out the president said, no, 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 we don't want you guys in charge. We want to have a say in this transition process because we want a real democracy. We don't trust this military because you guys backed this dictator for so long. And now, effectively, what the military has done has said, you know what, we're going to crack down on you. And so there have been deaths. And what's really fascinating about this is that the Saudi Arabians, the Emiratis, and apparently the Egyptians are also partly behind this crackdown. They have apparently been encouraging the Sudanese military to crack down on this because they have their own interests in Sudan. The U.S. does not seem to have much of a strategy beyond basically issuing sharply worded statements and saying that they've called Saudi and Emirati leaders, asking them to help calm down the violence there. And it just shows what a vacuum there is in terms of U.S. leadership.
It also shows that the president is not going to do anything that gets him crosswise with the Saudis, particularly Mohammed bin Sultan, the crown prince and the de facto ruler of Saudi Arabia. He is all in with the Saudis. And so I don't think the United States is going to press our allies in the region to crack down on the Sudanese military.
Well, we'll have to end it right there. Our thanks to two of Washington's most prominent journalists, Nahal Tusi of Politico and Tom DeFrank. He's contributing editor for National Journal. This program was produced by Patrice Martin, our engineer Justin Thwaites, and I'm Paul Brandis of West Wing Reports and USA Today. Thank you for joining us.